Hey everybody, before I get into today's episode, let me tell you about a great new game that I found. It's called Politics and War. Politics and War is a massive multiplayer online game that puts you in charge of your very own country. You literally start by founding your very own nation and you control every aspect of it from there. Want to go to war? Good luck. Want to work cooperatively with other countries for mutual benefit? Sure. Politics and War is the best nation sim game out there. If you've ever looked at a country and thought, man, I could do way better than those losers, then go to politicsandwar.com or download the app on Google Play or the Apple App Store today and see if you've got what it takes. I love this time of year. The crisp air of fall, the leaves changing from green to shades of red and gold, jack-o'-lanterns on doorsteps, fake spiderwebs in trees, giant inflatable skeletons, nothing makes me feel quite as alive as the fall. And the cherry on top is Halloween. It's one of my very favorite holidays, but unfortunately it's got a bit of a bad reputation. My name is Josh, and this is Obscure History. You've heard it a million times. Don't take candy from strangers. We've been conditioned to be wary of those we don't know. And for good reason. The unknown is the most terrifying force of all. That man asking kids if they want to pet his dog at the park might just be a kind old man who likes the kids at the park because he misses his grandchildren who moved across the country. Or he could be a predator waiting to find a vulnerable victim. Do you want to take that kind of risk? Certainly not. This fear of unfamiliar people is not new. I mean, think about our lineage of folklore about stranger danger. Folklores are used as sort of parables for teaching society's youngest members about the dangers of the world around them, and stranger danger is a very common trope. Hansel and Gretel trusted the kind old lady in the woods, and she tried to broil them in her oven. Little Red Riding Hood was duped by a stranger impersonating her beloved grandmother and was nearly killed for it. One of our oldest and most well-documented folklore characters, the Pied Piper, literally used magic powers to steal people's kids when they refused to pay for his services. And that's just three examples. I'm sure that you're thinking of some more examples right now. It's our most primal fear, the other, the unknown, the unfamiliar. The stranger. And perhaps now more than ever we are sensitive to the presence of strangers. We live in cities that are far more densely packed than they were when those folktales were written. Think about it. If you live in a place like Los Angeles or New York City, and I know that many people who listen to this show do, just ask yourself one question. How well do I know my neighbors? Like, do you know them at all? Like, really know them. Do you know their past, their goals, their triggers, their likes and dislikes? If you live in a major metropolitan area, there is a decent chance that you might not even really know the identity of the people who live beside, in front of, next to, above, and below you. And don't get me wrong, I don't mean to fearmonger. For every story of a dangerous stranger committing a crime or transgression against somebody they don't know, there are probably 10 stories about strangers helping people out when they're in need. If you ever need to feel more secure, think of every time you've ever seen somebody pull over to the side of the road to help somebody with their car trouble, or every time a delivery person went out of their way to serve you, or every time somebody has returned your lost phone or wallet to a customer service desk. I tend to believe that people are mostly good, but frankly, no matter what I say or what evidence I offer you, you'll likely still be hesitant around people you don't know. It's just baked into our society. A sort of subgenre of the broader category of stranger danger folklore can be called poison candy tales. The most notable example is probably Snow White. I'm sure you recall, but if you want just a brief refresher, Snow White is a popular folktale where a beautiful young girl eats a poisoned apple, given to her from a wicked witch. She then falls asleep, there's a kiss, and a happy ending, at least in the Disney version. But the contemporary history of the poison candy myth is fairly recent. Before the Industrial Revolution, food was almost exclusively made at home or by people known by those who purchased it at places like farmers markets or small, local grocery stores. But as the Industrial Revolution allowed production speed to grow exponentially, large companies began forming and began exporting food as a commodity to a much wider audience. This shift from people knowing where their food comes from directly to only having a vague idea of its source inspired a great deal of unease among the American public. Furthermore, the general public didn't have a functional understanding of the machines being used to process their food. Try to put yourself in a person's shoes at that time. Monday, you bought some canned peaches from old Farmer Dylan down at the fruit stand, but by the next Monday, you're buying canned peaches from Kraft at a grocery store, and the grocer tells you that a machine packaged it? Was it properly sterilized? Was the factory clean? Who put the peaches in the can? Did a machine prepare the liquid that's in the can? These are huge questions for a person who had never lived in an industrialized world before. And this experience wasn't just restricted to the general public. Doctors made claims that they were treating patients for food poisoning on a daily basis. To the best of our understanding, these claims were largely untrue, but it's difficult to tell even with our perfect hindsight. People were already hesitant about the new order of things, and then they were reading from doctors that they trusted that they were treating people with food poisoning daily. That is not a recipe for success. And as such, people blamed processed foods and candies for the unexpected deaths of their loved ones. If little Joseph dropped dead unexpectedly, it wasn't the lack of hygiene, the rampant spread of diseases like diphtheria, the accelerated pace of life, the fact that children were spending long days doing dangerous jobs, or the generally high rate of accidental maiming. It was that newfangled, prepackaged taffy. The public unease about processed foods was so intense that in the 1890s and 1900s, the U.S. Bureau of Chemistry and other agencies tested hundreds of kinds of candy. They found no evidence of poisoning or tampering. What these tests did discover, however, is that inexpensive glucose was in common use for cheap candies, that some candies contained trace amounts of copper from uncoated copper cooking pans, and that coal tar dyes were being used for coloring. But there was no evidence of poison, industrial waste, garbage, or any other contaminant that had been alleged. In a flavorful twist of irony, most of these investigations determined that people who had contracted some kind of food poisoning obtained it from meats and other foods prepared by themselves, their neighbors, or the small farms and grocery stores where they had purchased them from. There was another historical period that fostered this mistrust of strangers. During, and especially directly after the Civil Rights Movement, neighborhoods that were once firmly segregated were opened up to people of all races, cultural heritages, and ethnic backgrounds. But as we've seen throughout history, just because the law mandates inclusion, people don't abandon their prejudice. Sadly, as neighborhoods became more diverse, some areas became more judgmental, suspicious, and hateful. Unfortunately, rumors began to spread through these neighborhoods, and suddenly, those who had already been there believed the newcomers were abusive, criminal, and bizarre. And specifically, one of the rumors that took hold was that these new neighbors would tamper with Halloween treats. But I mean, those are just rumors, right? From a far-off time that doesn't really matter anymore. I mean, maybe. But before we investigate further, we need to pause for about 90 seconds to hear from some sponsors. So sit tight, and we'll be right back. If you're listening to this, then you're probably a nerd. And that's fine, this is a judgment-free zone. I'm a big nerd too. You know what big nerds like? Learning. And if you're a nerd that likes learning, then I've got an amazing opportunity for you. One Day University is your go-to spot. Every college has that one professor whose class was so popular that students just lined up to get into one of their classes before they graduate. One Day University brings over 200 of these top-rated professors together online to present incredible, live-streamed talks based on their most popular courses. Professors are selected from schools across the country, including Yale, Stanford, Harvard, Duke, Columbia, and many more. Every weekday, One Day University offers a new, one-hour live-streamed talk followed by a live Q&A with one of these professors. Members also get access to a library with over 500 past recorded talks available on demand. You can learn something new every day about history, politics, art, science, music, psychology, and so much more. There's no homework or tests, just the joy of learning new things from incredible professors. Memberships are just $8.95 a month or $89 a year, but you can try 2 weeks for free. Plus, if you use the code OBSCURE-HISTORY and sign up for an annual plan, you'll get your first year for half price. Join today to hear amazing lectures like Unexplained History, What Historians Don't Understand by Carolyn Winterer of Stanford University. Or maybe The Five Most Powerful People in the World by William Burke White of the University of Pennsylvania. And again, that's onedayu.com/obscure-history for a 2-week free trial. And if you like it, which I'm pretty sure you will, use promo code OBSCURE-HISTORY, capital O, capital H, for half off an annual membership plan. November 1st, 1969. Man arrested for trick-or-treat razor in Apple. A Torsdale area man was arrested Friday night on charges of giving a Halloween trick-or-treater an apple with a razor blade in it. Jack Thomas, 52, was arrested at his home after Grace Wistowski, 12, who lives across the street, found a razor blade in an apple and told police Thomas put it in her treat bag. Police said Thomas was charged with assault with intent to maim and cruelty to minors, a little-used juvenile law. In the Philadelphia area, there were about 25 cases of children being given razor blades, broken glass, wire staples, pills, and capsules while out trick-or-treating. Most of the razor blades were single-edged injector types pushing into apples, said police. Police Commissioner Frank A. Rizzo said every case of dangerous objects being given to children on Halloween would be investigated and arrests made where possible. "This makes me sick," he said. "What sick minds would do something like this to our young?" Despite numerous incidents, no injuries were reported, although detectives pointed out that some children may save the gifts from their bags to eat later. Jack Thomas, who on October 30th, was an unemployed foundry worker and neighborhood friend, awoke on November 1st as a criminal. He was taken into custody, put before a judge, and condemned for attempting to maim children. The community responded in outrage. They felt immensely betrayed by the man who just the week before they had affectionately called Uncle Jack. He had been known for baking cookies for the neighborhood children. Had those treats been tainted? Had he simply been building their trust for this one vile act? What if Grace and her friends had eaten the tainted apples? They could have died. The community that had once opened their homes and hearts to Uncle Jack turned against him. Teenage boys threatened to beat him, adults threatened to burn his house down, and the judge who saw him in court told him that if he were able, he would send him to the whipping post. In 1 week's time, he went from beloved neighbor to the boogeyman haunting every child's dreams. And perhaps it seemed so unbelievable to the community, because it wasn't true at all. Halloween hoax victim renamed. It's Uncle Applejack now. Kids in the neighborhood used to call him Uncle Jack, now it's Uncle Applejack. Jack B. Thomas chuckled as he told of his new name, but how he got it was no laughing matter. The big, balding, friendly Thomas wouldn't be chuckling today if it weren't for Matthew B. Glabocki, 44, a security guard at the housing project where Thomas lives. 2 weeks ago on Halloween, Thomas, 52, was accused by 6 girls of giving one of them an apple containing a razor blade while they were trick-or-treating. Unable to raise $10,000 bail, Thomas was fingerprinted, photographed, and jailed on charges of cruelty to children and intent to maim. Glabocki was suspicious of the girl's story. He started asking questions and soon overturned their apple cart. The girls admitted the whole thing was a hoax. Glabocki said he had seen Thomas around the housing project greeting and being greeted by neighborhood children. "I couldn't believe he did it," Glabocki said. "A driving force within me told me to look into the matter thoroughly." 2 days later, Thomas was released from jail and the girls were arrested on charges of giving police false information and conspiracy. Their case is pending in juvenile court. Thomas had been in police custody 5 days. 2 days ago, the charges against him were expunged by Municipal Judge William Markert. Thomas told the judge he held no grudge against the girls and did not plan to press charges against them. Thomas said the 6 girls, who aged 10 to 14, and their parents had come to see him since his release from jail. "They asked me how I felt. I told them I couldn't be angry with anybody. I'm a parent and a grandparent myself," said Thomas. "And a child is a child, and sometimes they do goofy things. I don't want to see them come to grief. I'd just like to see them try to understand this." However, despite Thomas's good intentions, Grace Wistowski, Debbie Connors, Grace's sister Carol, age 14, Jean Hammond, age 10, Catherine O'Leary, age 10, Joan Twillery, age 11, were taken to the Youth Study Center, then released to the custody of their parents for a hearing before juvenile court in about 2 weeks for allegedly falsifying a police report. It's one thing for us to read about the false accusations of tainted Halloween candy, but it's an entirely different thing for us to become acquainted with the details. Jack Thomas was a friendly neighbor who was detained for 2 weeks for something he didn't do. And once he was freed, an entire group of girls were swept into the criminal justice system for their actions. One rumor brought a dozen people to jail. It nearly cost a man his house, his reputation, and his physical well-being. This fear of strangers and of the unknown has real-world ramifications. But here's a secret that might make you feel better. Nobody has ever been caught intentionally tainting Halloween candy. I know that's shocking to hear, but despite receiving plenty of reports every year, nobody has ever been convicted of attempting to use Halloween candy to poison trick-or-treaters. There have been many notable cases that contribute to our fear of trick-or-treating, though. To quote an article from Mental Floss, in 1974, an 8-year-old boy named Timothy O'Brien died after eating cyanide-laced pixie sticks while trick-or-treating. Although the poisoning initially looked like it might have been the work of a deranged homeowner, the investigation into O'Brien's murder soon centered on his father, Ronald Clark O'Brien. A bit of digging revealed that Ronald O'Brien had recently taken out a hefty life insurance policy on both of his children, and police quickly built a case, albeit a circumstantial one, that O'Brien had given both Timothy and his daughter Elizabeth the poisoned candy to try and collect on their policies. To help cover his tracks, O'Brien also gave 2 other children cyanide pixie sticks. Luckily, his daughter and the other 2 children had passed up the poison powders in favor of other treats. O'Brien was eventually convicted and executed for murdering his son. While his crime was certainly a horrific one, it was hardly the sort of random poisoning that parents fear. And sadly, this case isn't all that unique. It is true that children do, on rare occasions, die during Halloween. But usually it's their parents who are the true monsters. On November 2nd, 1970, 5-year-old Kevin Tostin lapsed into a coma and died 4 days later of a heroin overdose. Analysis of some of his Halloween candy showed it had been sprinkled with heroin. Kevin's father blamed tainted Halloween candy for his son's death to try and cover up his own heroin use and negligence. And unfortunately, there are many more stories like that. In my research, the closest thing I found to somebody actually trying to tamper with Halloween candy to harm children was in 1959, when a disgruntled dentist passed out chocolate-covered laxatives for Halloween. And despite being very devious, it's not deadly by any means. However, despite the fact that there has never been a proven case of Halloween candy tampering, the fear persists. And every year, people claim that they've found some hideous evidence of someone trying to kill their kids, or that they found THC edibles mixed in with their normal Sour Patch Kids. It's easy to sit here on my high horse and tell you to stop judging your neighbors and to be more trusting of the people around you. But even as I write this, I have a hard time telling you that it's safe to take candy from strangers. Despite the evidence, despite the fact that I, myself, wrote this episode, I still feel some reservation deep in the back of my mind. Perhaps that's the true power of fear. Even once it's identified, completely proven, and utterly shattered, it still retains some mysterious hold on us. All right, everybody, thank you so much for listening. I appreciate each and every one of you. I've got just a couple of announcements here at the end, as usual, and I actually want to start by asking you a giant favor. If you could, there's a link in the show notes that is to an award, right? So if you could go to Best History Podcast, vote for Obscure History, and then submit it, all you need is your email address, and you can even click a box that says that, like, the Podcast Discovery Awards won't email you spam or whatever. That would be so rad. I did not nominate myself for this award, which makes it actually meaningful for me. but it is, like, a very cool award, and we're finalists along with shows like Hardcore History, which is insane to me. So legitimately, guys, if you could go vote for that, I would just, like, be eternally grateful. That'd be so cool if we won. Couple of announcements. I started last week the first ever Obscure History Thursday footnotes. Be prepared, because there will be Thursday footnotes of this episode. And I really enjoyed it. I think that I spent like a month trying to hammer out exactly what I was going to do with it. I feel pretty comfortable with it. If you liked it, let me know. If you hated it, also let me know, because I don't want to put something out that people aren't going to enjoy. And if you really enjoy it, then maybe I can work harder to tailor some of my other content to be maybe a little bit more structured, because Thursday footnotes definitely is very structured, and some people are really attracted to that. So just let me know what you think. Bad, good, ugly, whatever it is, I can take it. Also, if you want to write in questions for Thursday footnotes, I will be answering two audience questions every single week on Thursday footnotes. So if you would like to get a question answered on the show, you can find me at All The People Pod at Twitter, Obscure History Podcast at Instagram, or obscurehistorypod@gmail.com. I promise I will see everything that you send to me. I might not answer it on the show, but I'll do my best to answer it, even if it's just through a DM. Okay, so I know this was a little bit of a short episode. I hope that I told the story thoroughly, though. Again, if you listen to Thursday Footnotes, you know that I personally have rules for writing this show, and I felt like I communicated effectively, and if I tried to get anything else in this episode, it would have been forced, so I avoid that at all costs. Okay, so as always, guys, this episode is brought to you in part by Earbuds Podcast Collective and Indie Drop-In Network. Go check those guys out if you want to find new podcasts and you just, like, cannot bring yourself to do one more random Google search, because you know what Google will tell you every time is, like, lore and criminal and, like, Call Her Daddy or whatever that stupid show is. It might be great. I've never listened to it. I don't know. But the biggest problem in the podcast industry right now is discovery, and those two services seek to solve that problem. Indie Drop-In Network will deliver a fresh episode from a new podcast to your subscription feed every week. It's hand-curated. Greg is a great guy, so support him if you so choose. And Earbuds Podcast Collective is a hand-curated newsletter which gets dropped to your inbox in your email, and it is super cool too. You'll find out about shows that are big, small, medium, the whole gamut of shows are featured on that. So check those two out. There's going to be links in the bio. Also, Ariel Nissenblatt that runs Earbud Podcast Collective is also one of the most solid people in the podcast industry right now. So please check those guys out. They're friends of the show, and I always want to promote their stuff. Taking us out this week is Picked Up by Sounds of Satellites. I know that I just played this song a couple weeks ago, but I love it, and I also didn't check my spreadsheet of music to feature. If you would like your music featured on my show, do write in, send me your stuff. I promise I will add it to the spreadsheet, and next week I will check the spreadsheet. All right, guys, listen to the song. Go download Sound of Satellites, all of their music, because it's all my favorite. Okay, I gotta go. It's very late. I've got work in the morning. See ya.
Little reminder of what you said when you were bit but not poisoned. Holding a rattlesnake with a straight face in the dark makes me wonder. Reminds me when you picked up and left me.